I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at TVTimeMachine.com.
Oh! Don't kill me! No, I don't have any money. Here, you can have everything.
Colleen Randall, you've had your fun at the lady's expense. Now, you will not see her. You will not talk to her. You will not go to her daughter's school. You will not see or talk or be anywhere near her ever again. Because if I hear that you have even been walking down the same street that she is on, I will kill you. Now, do you understand that? Do you understand that? Huh? Leave the lady alone.
I swear.
We're back again with author and Equalizer writer and producer Coleman Locke right here on the TV Time Machine. You know, Coleman, we've played some clips that have a little bit of violence in them. Now, that was always kind of a tricky issue with the Equalizer. It had a reputation for being an extremely violent program, and yet the reality was most of the violence on that show was implied and performed off-screen. How did you guys react to that criticism and Edward Woodward? And did you ever consider that criticism justified?
Well, I'd say those are good questions. I know that when I first was going to join the Equalizer staff, I had a friend of mine who was a writer producer at Universal, and I told her that I was getting ready to join the staff, and she just looked at me with disdain. She said, "You're going to join this vigilante show?"
Right.
I think that that was the impression that Hollywood had and simply insisted upon throughout the entire time that we produced that series. It was a violent show. There's no question about it. And sometimes the violence was a little more than even, you know, you write something on a page and then the director may shoot it a little harder than you expect it to be shot. That happened a few times. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times, I don't remember, but there were many times when I would write a scene that would go something like this. Somebody would come up to the Equalizer and say, "Well, you've got a gun, why don't you just go and kill them? Why don't you shoot them?" And he would, the character of Robert McCall would look at them and simply say, don't you know that I remember the face of every person I've ever killed? And, you know, I mean, the issue of taking life seriously was something that we constantly attempted to do. We tried to do things that, you know, we did some things that I think nobody had ever done. We dealt with childhood AIDS on that series before Hollywood ever got into it. You know, things like that that, you know, we tried to have a sense of compassion. It was very difficult. I remember I was a member at the time of the Television Academy, and I watched for, I don't know, 3 years in a row, Edward would come up for Best Actor.
Right.
And, you know, and he would lose each time, I think several times, to Bruce Willis on Moonlight. And now, Bruce Willis is a terrific actor,
exactly.
But, you know, that was not a drama. And, you know, at the same time, the Academy was voting him in instead of this tremendous actor who was doing such tremendous work. I got so disgusted that I dropped out of the Academy and never joined again. You know, but I watched that happen all the way down, and I think that even today, Hollywood does not understand what The Equalizer was about. It was a story of a man who was searching for redemption, who was living, in a sense, a life of repentance, and was trying his hardest, you know, to work out all the bad things he had done by doing good things and stumbling as he went along to do it. You know, it was a story about that, And consequently, every time Hollywood has come up with something like this or attempted to, they've tried to redo it in different ways. They've just fallen on their face because all they look at is say, "Well, it's about a vigilante who's going out and, you know, and getting vengeance on people." And that was not what this series was. I think the audience understood that. I don't think Hollywood ever did.
Well, I think many times people criticize something without actually having seen it. And I think that was the case with The Equalizer, where maybe they saw one or two episodes, but you really have to watch the entire show to truly understand it.
I think that's true. People would look at the series on today, and you would understand that's true. Whether it's, you know, one of the primetime soaps, whatever it is, you realize you can't just drop into it and, you know, and understand the whole thing in one or two episodes. You're going to have to get into it and then commit yourself to it. Well, I think that because they had the idea that that each episode was a standalone episode, which they were, that they could figure out the whole episode by looking at one or two. I'm not even sure they did that much. Hollywood doesn't watch TV. I mean, people don't do that. So when they make decisions on the basis of, you know, of what will win an award or whatever, they're doing it for the most part out of ignorance. They don't even watch what they vote on in many cases.
Of course,
that was it for us.
Of course, we've talked about how extraordinary Edward Woodward was as an actor. Laurence Olivier once called him the greatest actor he ever saw. When Edward was doing those particularly violent scenes, like where he's slamming people up against the wall, he, as an actor, reaches an amazing level of rage. Were people surprised? Was he surprised that he was able to bring that out of him? And how did he feel after he performed a scene like that?
You know, this is not something that we had discussions about. I mean, you know, I never went up to him, or he never came up to me or anybody else and said, well, you know, here's how I feel about how I did this or that. He was very much a professional British actor. He was trained. He knew exactly where to tap into his own emotions and his own experiences. And, you know, and he was the consummate professional. So what I think his attitude was, we're all professionals here, and that's how he acted on the set. He was a tremendously strong, positive influence on the set, which, boy, actors can be the opposite. But, you know, he just did it, and then he turned around, and it was fine. Now, where he pulled all of that out from, I really could not answer that. I know he'd been through many difficult experiences in his life, as have we all. He'd made mistakes, and he had made right decisions in a lot of different areas. That's true for everybody. How he did it, I can't answer. I think the fact that you are able to show that kind of anger doesn't necessarily mean that you have it deep in you and you're
right,
pulling it out. When I was in the military, you know, I don't think that I'm an angry person at all. Yet before I went to Vietnam, I was a training officer, you know, training new troops. And I will tell you, I could come up with fake rage that was incredibly great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could scare the living daylights out of people. And I didn't feel it at all inside. So, you know, I mean, that's the best I can say is from my own experience, I know that you don't have to be enraged to show rage or show anger. You know, but the important thing is that clearly it's under control, whatever it is. You turn it on, you turn it off. That was the story in the military for me. It was a spigot. You turned it on, you turn it off, and you knew how to do it. But it wasn't there controlling your life.
Well, Coleman, in the last season of The Equalizer, you wrote a script entitled Splinters, in which the KGB kidnaps McCall's friend Mickey.
I know where this is going.
Yes, this particular show contains a cryptic and memorable final line, as we'll hear in this clip.
We'll take over from here. You know, this is a real feather in your cap, old son. Mr. Olford is very impressed. He has asked me to extend an invitation for you to rejoin the company.
You are joking, of course.
No, I'm quite serious. No, he's promised greatly increased pay and stimulating travel.
Oh, is this for real?
No. No, it's not.
Always remember that nothing real has happened since 1957.
Okay, I know you're not going to answer this question, so why should I ask it?
Okay. I have been asked that question so many times, and my response is always the same. It'll go to my grave with me.
Yeah, why 1957? What's going on here? What?
I know, that is the question that is always asked. And I've had people go out and they say, you know, I've searched all through the history of 1957. The mystery has to remain. That's all I can say. It was tremendously fun to write that episode. I mean, I got to, put Mickey Kosmeyer into an isolation tank and, all kinds of weird things. You know, I got to get into surrealism. I mean, that's what you asked before about what we could do in modern-day technology. That was what we were doing back then, you know, with isolation tanks and the idea of, you know, of moving into other dimensions in a way, at least in your mind, and making those appear to be real. Oh, you could do so much more with that today, but Oh, I had a lot of fun. That episode was a lot of fun to write, especially going down to the set and seeing, you know, old Mickey, lying there in the water.
Well, we haven't talked about Mickey.
Yeah.
Who was the character of Mickey Kossmeyer, and who was the actor who played him?
Oh my goodness! You know, I'm having a senior moment, and it's terrible.
Oh, it was like Keith Jarabaka.
Keith Kossmeyer. Yeah.
Right.
Yes, he a tremendous actor. He is still working today. You know, he is just. I didn't create the character. He was created in the first season. I believe that he is something that he's one that Joel Cerno may have come up with. I'm not sure. Played wonderfully. He is a former Navy SEAL, if you can imagine how early that issue was coming up.
Oh, yeah.
He was no longer a SEAL. And when I got involved in the series, I mean, I had a military background, and I had some knowledge of who the SEALs were in Vietnam and so forth. They were not in the kind of form they are today. But back in that day, I knew that they were SEALs, and I knew something about them, but I had to learn more. Many years later, my own son became a Navy SEAL.
Wow.
In reality, so I've learned a whole lot more since then. But you know, he became this. He was the sort of the strong arm for Edward, and for the character of Robert McCall. When he needed backup, when he needed somebody who was great with weapons, with martial arts, with anything. I mean, this was, he was. You know, the amazing thing was when they cast that character, they chose someone who really is like a Navy SEAL today, which is amazing. You would think that Navy SEALs are just these huge guys. Of course, you've got Active Valor that's coming out, that they're tremendously strong. They are tremendously strong, but they're also very deceptive. My own son is not a huge man, but he was. No one would believe that he's a SEAL, but he was a Navy SEAL, and that was the way it was for Mickey Kossmeyer. So. It was a brilliant piece of casting, a brilliant character to have created. He was tremendously fun to work with, and just had a great time writing for that character.
How important was Mickey Kossmeyer to the show, especially during the third year?
He was very important. He became a kind of bridge, somebody who really was part of McCall and his team, and we used him frequently. Keith Jarabika was just tremendous to work with. He is a consummate actor himself, and he could just pull it off. And so, we depended upon him. He was of all the people that had been around McCall in the first two seasons. He was the one I think who was like the figure of a son to Robert McCall, and at the same time he was a fellow soldier, in a sense. So he was a link. I don't know what we would have done without him. Certainly, the action sequences. There's only so much you can make believable when you are having a man in his 50s who is throwing people up against the wall, especially if they happen to be young and very strong.
Right.
We had to be cautious about how much we used Edward for action sequences, just because it was just not going to be believable. And so Mickey took that part.
Do you think The Equalizer helped pave the way for today's style of TV dramas?
I can't answer that, really. I don't know the style of TV drama that we have today. There's such a range of things. Certainly you have a huge sea change that took place between doing standalone episodes for series and series that just go on and never really kind of close out, except individual storylines in the course of this huge arc. I don't think that we influenced much of that way, except, I'm not sure that I can, maybe by the misunderstanding of who The Equalizer was, there is a sense that Hollywood has gotten more violent and more dark. I think about series like Dexter that have come up. I mean, horrendous concepts. I hope we didn't influence those things, but maybe we did. I don't know.
Well, I think you influenced The Mentalist.
Yes, there are some that are like that are sort of procedural in a way.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call us really procedural. I don't think we really were that. We went back and forth. We certainly had our procedures, and we did our episodes in which we would call them, you know, the sort of the meat and potatoes episode, the Equalizer Helps Somebody in Need. But we were constantly playing away from that particular palette into other areas. And I don't know. I mean, yes, but procedurals, they've been around forever, though, too. I mean, so...
Dragnet.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Dragnet. And so many others. I mean, you know, you had great series that that were on at the same time that we were on that certainly had a lot of influence too. So,
do you watch much television today, and what do you think of the state of television today?
That's
a loaded question.
I'm not a big fan of much TV today. But you know, the truth is that I never really was. Even when I was working in television, I was not a huge fan of TV. I'm a fan of storytelling. Now, there's some great stories. I've mentioned Downton Abbey, I think, a great series that's on. You know, but there's a kind of darkness about some things now that it just disturbs me a lot. And I mean, you know, I'm not talking about the sort of the primetime soaps. They're always there. They are what they are. But I think about things like series like Dexter, you know, a serial killer out there killing other serial killers and all this stuff. And I, you know, I got involved. I started to get involved in this new Netflix series, Lilyhammer.
Mm-hmm.
And I really was enjoying it. I saw the first two episodes, and I thought, wow, this is so much fun. I'm having a great time. And then in the middle of episode three, there is this one scene that is so vile, so horrifying, and it has to do with a child in it, that I just said, you know what, I can't watch this anymore. This is garbage.
Right.
You know, and I find myself not watching very much because there is not much that is, as far as I'm concerned, worth watching. Now, once again, those who get involved in funny series like Desperate Housewives, there's some great writing that's done, and, you know, darkly humorous, and I love dark humor. So there are some great series that have been on, but I can't say I'm really a TV watcher.
Are you more of a book reader? Because you're certainly a book writer.
Yes, I do read a lot of books, and I have always read a lot of books. I think that the one thing that I never have really read any of were spy stories.
Interesting.
People were constantly coming up to us and, you know, on the Equalizer and saying, wow, you know, you must really read a lot of Le Carré. I never read a single book by Le Carré.
Wow.
You know, and we had people who worked in the agency, or we would get word through consultants. Wow, there's a lot of people who work in the agency and, you know, in the CIA who really love this series, and you captured a lot. You know, all of that was strictly, I don't know where it came from, you know. But, you know, I read a lot of books. I don't read a lot of novels. I read a lot of, you know, of... just a range of stuff, you know, that covers everything. My recent study has been in transhumanism and what's happening in that field, and you know, which is kind of scary, and there's just a lot of stuff that I read.
Well, speaking of books, tell us about your book, Angel Fall.
Well, Angel Fall is, it was a labor of love. It started all the way back in, I think, 1983. I had just broken into the industry, and I was writing scripts, feature scripts for the studios, and I had begun to really believe that all the fantasies that I'd had in my mind about freedom of creativity did not exist in Hollywood. And so, you know, I was a little bit frustrated. My kids were small, and I started just for them writing a novel, and I would write a chapter and read it to them, and then write another chapter, and I think I wrote about 8 chapters of this novel, and then suddenly I got into television, and I stopped writing, and they were not happy with me. They were not getting, and they didn't get any more chapters for years and years. I wanted to, I'd actually read, to my children, I'd read a classic fantasy novel. I won't name which one it was, but it's extremely well known, and the writer is one of the great writers of fantasy. And I read the novel, and I read it, and I just said, you know, wow, this is it's amazing. But it was amazing as long as the story stayed in this world. And the last quarter of the book, it went to a different world. And from that moment on, it just fell apart and fell flat for me. And I just thought, wow, okay, this is a classic writer, extremely talented, and you're criticizing this writer's work. Well, can you do any better? And so I decided that I would try to write a novel that would be set almost entirely on another world, where you have to create a complete world. And that is I don't think there's any greater challenge for a writer than to do that. Now, whether I've accomplished it or not is a separate issue, but that was one of the goals. And I also wanted to write a story about children or young people, in reality, they're not really children, but children or young people from this world who bring into it all of the tragedies that are in their lives, and you take those young people and put them into a different world, and in that world, they have to deal with all the things that they've experienced and become different people in the process of that. And that's really what Angel Fall is about. It's about a world that is on the edge of total darkness, on the edge of control by the greatest evil, and there are certain horrific scenes in it. It touches on horror, and yet it's a story about redemption. And you know, and it's a world that has been ruled by seven great powers that we might call angels, but they don't look like angels at all from the way we think about angels in our sort of tradition, our mythological traditions. But it's a world that is on the edge of going to pieces. And these three young people who have to go on a journey when they get there, each of them has a different journey to make. They're in the process of trying to save this world. So that's in a nutshell, I suppose, what the story's about.
Well, Angel Fall came out, I think, in 2009?
That's right.
Do you have another project that you're working on that you can tell us about?
And you know, I've completed a second. It's the second novel that I've written, but it's meant to be the first of a trilogy. I'm not completely settled on what the title will be. It is right now. I'm calling it The Mentalist Prophecies. The first book is Dagon's Illusion. And I'm sort of going on the basis of my interest in mentalism, and I've created a character who is sort of the greatest mental illusionist and one of the greatest escape artists of his time. And it's set in New Orleans during the whole book. The first book is really set during the night that Katrina arrives. And you know, it is a supernatural novel. It deals with occult issues. And it's about this man, and you know, and what is going on, and different levels of reality, and we deal with different dimensions of reality in this book, and it's meant to be the first of a trilogy, hopefully. So, I'm not sure how I'm going to publish that yet. I'm sort of going the route at this point of self-publishing because I haven't been all that happy with the way traditional publishers work after my first experience. But so we shall see.
Well, Angel Fall is available on Amazon.com, and you have a website as well?
Yes, and it is out. It's on Kindle through Amazon. I have a website. My website is ColemanLuck.com, humbly titled. As you know. and my name is Coleman Luck. People make that mistake sometimes with taking out the E. But and they can find out more about what I've been doing.
Well, you're lucky that your name isn't John Smith, because...
John Smith.
That'd be a tough URL to get. Yeah. Coleman, looking back on The Equalizer, now almost 30 years later, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, first of all, I'm just tremendously grateful for the opportunity to have done that series. It was, I count it as like a great gift from God to me. I truly mean that. It was so much fun to do. You know, you don't appreciate some things fully until you're away from them. And, you know, I didn't create that series. I was given the opportunity to influence it deeply. The opportunity to have worked with a team that, you know, that we worked with there, That's what is so much in my mind as I think about it. I miss the people who have passed on. You know, I I think about the opportunity to have the freedom to say things that I never had the freedom to do before or since. I find that to be sad, but it was the truth. I mean, I didn't create the series when I went on to create other series that theoretically were supposed to be my own as a creator. I didn't have anywhere near the kind of freedom that I had working on that series. And, you know, and I had, in fact, quite the opposite in several cases. So I look at it, and I just think it was unusual. I think rarely, hardly ever, does a writer have the opportunity to work with such a situation. And it was at a specific period of history. I doubt that there will ever be another series like The Equalizer. I sincerely believe that is not going to happen. And, you know, I'd love to believe that there could be, but the way things are moving, I sincerely doubt it. So I look back and think, thank you, God, for this opportunity.
Well, Coleman, it's been a tremendous pleasure having you aboard the TV Time Machine once again. Feel free to join us again in the future or in the past.
Thank you, Jim.
This is Jim Benson. Join us again next time as our magical transport takes us on yet another journey exploring television's past, present, and future. You'll find your next adventure right here on the TV Time Machine.